A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how fathers can lay solid foundations for a lifelong and loving relationship with their sons during those first couple of years. And he's not looking for the surface level, just be present stuff. He wants the concrete, the overlooked, the things that actually compound over decades. It's a good question.
It's a fantastic question. And you know what struck me reading it? Most advice for new fathers is basically, help mom, don't drop the baby, and maybe read a board book, which is the parenting equivalent of telling someone learning to cook that they should try using a pan.
The glockenspiel of fatherhood advice. Technically an instrument, but nobody's composing symphonies with it.
And meanwhile, the first 2 years are this incredibly dense window where the relational scaffolding is literally being built. I went back through a bunch of the developmental attachment literature for this one, and it's remarkable how much of what we consider a close adult relationship traces its architecture back to patterns set before the kid can even talk.
Where does a father actually start? What's the first thing that isn't just be there?
And tumble play. And I want to be specific about this because it's not just wrestle with your kid sometimes. There's a researcher named Richard Fletcher at the University of Newcastle in Australia who's been running the Fathers and Families Research Program for years. He's found that rough and tumble play between fathers and infants, starting as early as 6 to 8 months, activates a completely different neurobiological system than the nurturing caregiving system mothers typically engage. When a mother soothes an infant, both their oxytocin levels rise, heart rates sink downward, cortisol drops. It's a co-regulation toward calm. When a father does rough and tumble, tossing the baby gently, chasing games, that kind of excited physical play, you see a different pattern. Both parties spike in oxytocin still, but there's also a dopamine surge, and the infant's heart rate goes up and then down in a controlled way. The baby is learning to manage arousal states. It's essentially the first laboratory for emotional regulation.
Dad is basically the baby's first stress test, in a good way.
In exactly a good way. Fletcher's work shows that toddlers whose fathers engaged in regular rough-and-tumble play showed measurably fewer behavioral problems at ages 3 and 5. The mechanism appears to be that the father is teaching the child, implicitly, how to handle excitement without tipping into dysregulation. You get riled up, you laugh, you almost lose control, and then dad pulls back, the intensity drops, and you learn that feeling big feelings doesn't mean being consumed by them.
I can already hear someone thinking, okay, but what if I'm not a roughhousing kind of dad? Is this one of those things where if you don't do it, the kid's doomed?
No, not at all. Fletcher's team has been careful about this. The research isn't saying roughhousing is the only path. It's saying the underlying mechanism. Helping the child learn to navigate excitement and arousal in a safe container is what matters. You can do that through exuberant storytelling, through music, through building things together, and having them topple over dramatically. The key is the cycle of excitation and return to baseline, with you as the regulator.
The container, not the contents.
And that's a theme that runs through a lot of the best fatherhood research. The specific activity matters less than the relational pattern it creates.
That's the physical play piece. You mentioned attachment patterns before.
Yeah, so this is where I want to talk about something genuinely under-discussed, paternal sensitivity. There was a major meta-analysis published in the Journal of Family Psychology that looked specifically at paternal sensitivity and its effects on child attachment security. The finding was that fathers' sensitive responsiveness predicted secure attachment in children about as strongly as mothers did. The effect size was around 0.13, which in attachment research is meaningful.
Define paternal sensitivity for me, because I think most people hear that and picture a dad being gentle or emotionally available in a kind of generic way.
In the research, paternal sensitivity specifically means the father's ability to notice the child's signals, interpret them accurately, and respond promptly and appropriately. It's not about being warm in some diffuse sense. It's about attunement. The baby looks away because they're overstimulated. Does Dad notice and back off, or does he keep trying to engage? The toddler is frustrated with a toy. Does Dad read that frustration accurately and offer just enough support without taking over? That moment-to-moment attunement is what builds the sense of, this person gets me.
Which is basically the foundation of any close relationship, just happening before the kid has words.
And here's something that surprised me. There's evidence that paternal sensitivity may be especially important for boys when it comes to later emotional vocabulary. A study out of the University of Michigan followed families from infancy through early childhood and found that fathers who were highly attuned to their sons' emotional states at 12 months had sons who, at age 4, could name and describe their emotions with significantly more nuance than peers whose fathers had been less attuned.
The stereotype about men not being able to talk about feelings, that might literally start at age 1 with whether Dad was reading them correctly.
That's the implication. The child learns that their internal states are legible to another person. If your father consistently notices when you're frustrated, scared, excited, curious, and responds in a way that shows he understands, you internalize the idea that emotions are communicable. They're not just private storms. They can be shared and regulated in relationship.
Which then connects back to the rough and tumble thing, because that's also about regulating in relationship.
Right. And this is what I find so compelling about the first 2 years. All these seemingly separate things, physical play, emotional attunement, responsive caregiving, they converge on a single developmental task. The child is building an internal working model of what relationships are. Is the other person reliable? Do they notice me? Can I bring my full self? Excited, scared, angry, curious, and still be held.
Let's get practical for a second. A father hears this and thinks, okay, I'm supposed to be attuned. I'm supposed to roughhouse. I'm supposed to be responsive. What does that actually look like at, say, 8 months? What's a concrete thing to do on a Tuesday?
At 8 months, one of the most powerful things is what some researchers call serve and return interactions. The baby makes a sound, you make a sound back. The baby points at something, you look at it and name it. The baby drops a spoon, you pick it up with a funny expression. It sounds trivial, but these back and forth exchanges are literally building the neural architecture for communication and reciprocity.
It's basically conversational tennis before either of you knows the rules.
The father's role here is not fundamentally different from the mother's in terms of the mechanism, but there is an interesting difference in style that shows up in the research. Fathers tend to use more novel words, more unexpected responses. A mother might say, yes, that's a ball, when the baby points at a ball. A father is more likely to say, that's a ball. What does it do? Where's it going? It's a more challenging, less predictable linguistic environment.
Which tracks with the arousal regulation pattern from the roughhousing. Dad is introducing a bit more novelty, a bit more stretch.
And this is not to say one style is better than the other. The child benefits from both. The mother's predictable, soothing style creates safety. The father's more challenging, novel style creates opportunities for learning to handle unpredictability. Together, they give the child a full range of relational experiences.
Okay, so we've got rough and tumble play, we've got attunement and serve and return, we've got the novelty piece. What about the thing nobody wants to talk about, which is that the first 2 years are also when a lot of fathers feel completely useless?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is where the research on paternal depression comes in, and it's something wildly under-discussed. There's a well-documented phenomenon of postpartum depression in fathers. Estimates range from about 8 to 10% of new fathers experiencing significant depressive symptoms in the first year. But here's what I find striking. There's a secondary spike around the 12-month mark that's less about hormonal shifts and more about role confusion.
Role confusion meaning what exactly?
Meaning the father has spent a year trying to figure out what his job is. The mother, especially if she's breastfeeding, has a very clear, biologically defined role in the infant's life. The father's role is more culturally constructed and often less clear. By 12 months, many fathers report feeling peripheral. They love the baby, but they don't feel essential to the baby. And that sense of being optional, it can really erode engagement over time.
Which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You feel peripheral, so you pull back, so you become more peripheral.
And the antidote, according to the research, is not just do more. It's finding specific domains where the father is the primary person. It could be bath time. It could be the bedtime routine. It could be Saturday morning breakfast. Something where the father is not helping mom, but is the go-to parent for that activity.
Like owning a beat, not just being a session musician.
That's a perfect way to put it, and there's actually some fascinating longitudinal work on this. Fathers who established a specific, regular caregiving routine with their infants, something they consistently did, just the two of them, reported higher relationship satisfaction with their children at ages 5, 10, and even 15. The routine itself didn't matter. What mattered was that the child learned, implicitly, this is dad time, dad is the person for this.
It's not about quantity of time, it's about reliability of role.
And I want to be careful here because I think there's a version of this advice that becomes, just do bath time and you're good, which is not what I'm saying. The reliability is what creates the container. Within that container, you do all the other things we've been talking about. The attunement, the play, the serve and return. But the container itself is what tells the child this relationship is a constant.
What about the emotional piece for the father himself? Because I think a lot of men go into fatherhood with this idea that they're supposed to be the steady one, the rock, and then they find themselves feeling things they didn't expect. Jealousy of the mother-infant bond, frustration at the baby, boredom, resentment. And then they feel guilty about feeling those things.
This is such an important point, and it's where I think the cultural scripts around fatherhood really fail men. The script is basically, be proud, be protective, be patient, be grateful. Anything outside that narrow band is treated as a moral failing rather than a normal human response to an enormously disruptive life change.
What does the research actually say about this?
There's a really interesting body of work on what's called paternal reflective functioning. It's the father's capacity to hold his own mental states and the child's mental states in mind simultaneously. To notice, I'm feeling frustrated right now because the baby won't stop crying. And the baby is crying because he's overtired, and both of these things can be true without either of us being bad. Fathers with higher reflective functioning have children with more secure attachment, independent of how much time they spend together.
The skill is not, don't feel negative things. The skill is, notice what you're feeling without letting it define your response.
And this is trainable, which is the hopeful part. There are interventions. The one I'm thinking of is called the Fathers and Babies Program, developed out of the University of Michigan, that specifically teach reflective functioning skills to new fathers. Fathers who went through the program showed not only better mental health outcomes for themselves, but measurably better social-emotional development in their infants at follow-up.
We've talked about what fathers can do directly with their kids. What about the relationship with the mother? How much does the father-son bond depend on the father-mother bond?
It's huge. There's a concept in family systems research called spillover. Positive or negative emotions from the co-parenting relationship spill over into the parent-child relationship. A father who feels supported and valued by his partner is more likely to be patient, playful, and attuned with his child. A father who feels criticized, sidelined, or disconnected from his partner is more likely to be withdrawn or irritable with the child.
Which means part of being a good father to a son is being a good partner to the son's mother. Not in a performative way, but in a way that actually maintains the relational ecosystem.
And there's a specific dynamic worth naming. Sarah Shapa Sullivan at Ohio State University has done extensive work on what she calls maternal gatekeeping. It's the degree to which mothers encourage or discourage fathers' involvement with their children. What she's found is that mothers who engage in more gate-opening behavior, actively inviting the father's participation, affirming his competence, making space for his relationship with the child, have partners who are more engaged fathers. Conversely, mothers who gate-close, criticize the father's parenting, take over tasks, position themselves as the only competent parent, have partners who withdraw.
I imagine the father's response to gate closing is part of the equation too. You can either withdraw, which confirms the gate closing, or you can stay engaged in a way that gradually builds trust.
That's exactly the dynamic. And the research suggests that the most effective response is not confrontation, but persistence. Fathers who stay engaged despite gate closing, who keep showing up, keep offering, keep building their own relationship with the child, tend to see the gate closing decrease over time. The mother learns through experience that the father is competent, and the father builds confidence through practice.
The advice is basically, don't let yourself be sidelined, but don't make it a fight either. Just keep showing up.
And I think this is actually harder than it sounds, because it requires a kind of emotional steadiness that's difficult when you're sleep-deprived and feeling insecure about your role. But the payoff is enormous.
Let's talk about something more specific to sons. Is there anything in the research about father-son dynamics specifically versus father-daughter? Because the prompt is specifically about sons.
There is, and I want to be careful about how I present this, because a lot of the older research on father-son relationships is steeped in pretty rigid gender essentialism. But there are some findings that I think are useful without being prescriptive.
Give me the non-essentialist version.
One finding that's held up across multiple studies is that fathers tend to be more physically playful with sons than with daughters, not universally, but on average. And the interesting part is that this difference seems to be driven more by the father's expectations than by any actual difference in what the children want or respond to. When researchers control for the child's actual behavior, the father's behavior still differs by the child's perceived gender.
Fathers are projecting a script onto their sons before the sons even have a preference.
And the implication for building a strong relationship is to be aware of that. Ask yourself, am I roughhousing with my son because he enjoys it and we're connecting through it, or because I think that's what you're supposed to do with boys? If it's the latter, you might be missing opportunities for other kinds of connection. Quiet closeness, verbal exchanges, nurturing touch that your son might also need and want.
What about the emotional expression piece? The boys don't cry thing. Does that start this early?
There's evidence that parents, both mothers and fathers, respond differently to emotional distress in infant boys versus infant girls. A study from the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry found that parents were quicker to respond to crying in infant girls than in infant boys, and when they did respond, they used more emotional language with girls. With boys, the responses were more instrumental, let's fix the problem, rather than let's name the feeling.
Even before the kid can talk, we're already teaching him that his emotional distress is less worthy of a nurturing response.
And I want to be clear, this is not a conscious thing. Most parents would be horrified to think they're treating their sons and daughters differently, but the data is pretty consistent on this. And the long-term consequence is that boys learn at a pre-verbal level that certain emotional needs are not going to be met with attunement. They learn to suppress or redirect those needs.
Which then shows up 20 years later as a man who can't name what he's feeling.
And the intervention here is so simple, it almost feels trivial. Respond to your son's emotional distress with the same warmth and verbal labeling you'd use with a daughter. When he's crying, name the feeling. You're really frustrated right now. That toy is not doing what you want. It feels unnatural to some fathers because they weren't raised that way themselves. But the research is clear that it builds emotional literacy.
We're talking about breaking a generational pattern in real time with a 6-month-old.
And that's both the challenge and the opportunity of the first 2 years. The patterns haven't set yet. You're building the foundation, and you get to decide what goes into it.
You mentioned earlier that you went through some of the attachment literature. What's the actual mechanism by which a secure attachment to a father specifically benefits a son long term?
There's a really elegant longitudinal study, the NICHD study of early child care, which followed over 1,000 children from birth through adolescence. They found that children with secure attachments to their fathers at 15 months showed better social skills, fewer behavioral problems, and higher academic achievement all the way through elementary school. But for boys specifically, the father attachment was especially predictive of peer relationship quality. Boys who were securely attached to their fathers were better at managing conflict with peers, better at entering new peer groups, and less likely to be either aggressive or withdrawn in social situations. The hypothesis is that the father-son relationship serves as a template for male-male relationships outside the family. If your primary experience of a close male relationship is one where you can be vulnerable, express needs, and receive attunement, you carry that template into friendships.
That's actually a pretty profound reframe. The father-son bond isn't just about the two of them. It's the son's first draft of what male intimacy looks like.
And when you look at it that way, the stakes of the first 2 years become much clearer. You're not just changing diapers and doing bedtime. You're building a relational prototype that your son will carry into every male friendship, every mentoring relationship, and eventually his own fatherhood.
Okay, let me push on something. All of this sounds great in theory, but the reality of the first 2 years is that fathers are often exhausted, distracted, and frankly bored. A lot of infant care is tedious. How do you build this deep, attuned relationship when you're also just trying to survive?
This is such an important question, and I think it's where a lot of the advice falls apart. The be attuned, be present, be emotionally available. Advice assumes a baseline of energy and cognitive bandwidth that many new fathers simply don't have.
What's the actual advice for the exhausted father?
First, lower the bar on what counts as quality time. You don't need a special activity or a dedicated hour of focused interaction. The attunement we've been talking about can happen in 5-minute bursts throughout the day. Changing a diaper with full attention on the baby, narrating what you're doing, responding to his facial expressions, making it a tiny interaction rather than a transaction. That's attunement. The research doesn't require marathon sessions of focused parenting. It requires consistent micro moments of genuine connection.
I like that. It takes the pressure off the idea that you need to be on for hours.
And the second thing is related, protect your own mental health. A depressed, anxious, or completely depleted father cannot be attuned, no matter how much he wants to be. Part of being a good father in the first 2 years is taking care of yourself. Sleep when you can, exercise when you can, maintain at least some adult social connections, and if you're struggling, get help. The stigma around paternal mental health is still real, and is costing fathers and sons.
The airplane oxygen mask rule. Put yours on first.
And I want to say this clearly. Seeking help for depression or anxiety is not a failure of fatherhood. It's an act of fatherhood. You're ensuring that the person your son depends on is functioning.
What about the role of physical affection that isn't roughhousing? Just holding, cuddling, that kind of thing. Does that matter for fathers and sons?
It matters enormously, and I think it's another area where cultural scripts can get in the way. There's still a lingering discomfort in some circles about physical affection between fathers and sons, especially as boys get older. But in the first 2 years, there's no excuse for that. Skin-to-skin contact between fathers and infants has been shown to reduce cortisol levels in both parties, increase oxytocin, and promote bonding. There was a really nice study out of Quebec that looked at fathers who practiced regular skin-to-skin contact with their newborns, just holding the baby against their chest for 20 or 30 minutes a day, and found significant improvements in father-infant attachment at 3 months compared to a control group.
That's not just for newborns.
The skin-to-skin research is mostly on newborns, but the broader principle of physical affection, holding, carrying, cuddling, remains important throughout infancy and toddlerhood. Physical touch is a primary channel of communication before language. It says, you're safe, you're held, you belong, in a way that words can't.
If a father is not naturally physically affectionate, and some people aren't, is this something he should consciously practice?
Yes, and I think it helps to reframe it not as being affectionate, but as communicating through a channel your son understands. You don't need to feel a certain way to hold your baby. The behavior can precede the feeling. And the research suggests that for many fathers, the feeling follows. The oxytocin release from physical contact is not dependent on pre-existing affection. It's a biological response to the contact itself.
That's actually reassuring. You don't have to feel the bond to build the bond.
And I think that's one of the most important things to communicate to new fathers. The bond is not a lightning strike. For many fathers, it's a slow build. And that's normal. The cultural expectation is that you'll see your baby and be overwhelmed with love, and when that doesn't happen for some fathers, they think something's wrong with them. But the research is clear that paternal bonding often develops more gradually than maternal bonding, and it's mediated by caregiving behavior. The more you do, the more you feel.
Which circles back to the owning a beat thing. Having the regular caregiving routine isn't just about the baby learning to trust you. It's about you learning to feel connected to the baby.
The arrow goes both ways. Every time you successfully soothe your son, every time you make him laugh, every time you figure out what he needs and provide it, your brain is learning. This is my person. I am essential to this person. The relationship is built in those small victories.
Let's talk about something that I think gets overlooked in these conversations. The father is not just building a relationship with a baby. He's building a relationship with a future man. Is there anything about the first 2 years that specifically sets up a healthy adult father-son relationship?
That's a great framing. One of the things that shows up in the research on adult father-son relationships is that the quality of the relationship in adulthood is predicted not by specific childhood experiences, but by the overall pattern of the father's availability and responsiveness over time. Sons who describe their fathers as someone I could always go to or someone who really knew me tend to have closer adult relationships with their fathers.
Knowing someone. That starts with the attunement we were talking about. Noticing who they are before they can tell you.
The father who is attuned to his infant son's unique temperament, preferences, and rhythms, that father is already doing the work of knowing his son as an individual. And that pattern of attention, of curiosity about who this person is, can persist across the entire relationship. The son learns, my father sees me, my father is interested in who I actually am, not just who he wants me to be.
Which is the opposite of the I want you to be a doctor like me stereotype.
And that stereotype, the father who has a script for his son's life, that's essentially a failure of attunement. It's seeing the idea of a son rather than the actual son in front of you. And that pattern can start incredibly early. The father who is disappointed that his infant son isn't more physically active or more outgoing, that's already a misattunement.
Part of the foundation is basically radical acceptance of who the kid actually is.
And I want to be clear that this doesn't mean permissive parenting or no boundaries. It means seeing your son clearly and loving the person you see, not the person you expected or hoped for. That's the foundation of a lifelong relationship. The son knows, at a bone-deep level, that he is loved for himself.
What about discipline? The first 2 years, you're not really disciplining in the traditional sense, but you're starting to set boundaries. How does that fit into building a loving relationship?
This is where the distinction between discipline and punishment becomes really important, even with very young children. In the first 2 years, discipline is mostly about creating a safe environment and redirecting. The toddler who's about to touch a hot stove, you stop him, you say, no, that's hot, and you redirect to something else. What you're not doing is treating the behavior as a moral failing that requires a punitive response.
Because a 14-month-old doesn't have the cognitive capacity for moral reasoning.
And here's what's interesting from a relationship perspective. The way you handle these early boundary-setting moments teaches your son something about conflict in your relationship. If your response to unwanted behavior is consistently firm but not frightening, clear but not angry, the child learns that conflict with you is safe. Disagreement doesn't threaten the relationship.
Which is huge for later. If a teenage son knows he can disagree with his father without the relationship falling apart, he's more likely to actually talk to his father about things that matter.
And that pattern starts with how you handle a 1-year-old grabbing at your glasses. If you get angry and punitive, the child learns that displeasing you is dangerous. If you're calm and redirect, the child learns that boundaries exist, but the relationship is secure.
We've covered a lot of ground here. Rough and tumble play, attunement, serve and return, owning a caregiving beat, reflective functioning, physical affection, radical acceptance, safe boundary setting. If you had to distill this down for a father who's overwhelmed and just wants to know the one thing to focus on, what would it be?
I'd say pay attention. Not in a generic, be present way, but in the specific sense of watching your son closely enough to learn who he is and what he's telling you. Everything else we've talked about, the play, the attunement, the routines, they all flow from that. If you're paying attention, you'll notice when he's overstimulated, when he's seeking connection, when he's frustrated, when he's delighted. And you'll respond to what's actually happening, not to a script in your head about what fatherhood is supposed to look like.
That's good. Pay attention to the actual child in front of you, not the idea of a child.
And the other piece I'd emphasize is, don't panic if you don't feel the bond immediately. For a lot of fathers, the love grows through the doing. Every diaper change, every feeding, every middle-of-the-night soothing, these are not interruptions to your life. They are the relationship being built, one small interaction at a time.
The micro moments.
Before we wrap, I want to ask about something that's been in the back of my mind through this whole conversation. We've been talking about what fathers can do, but a lot of this depends on having the opportunity. What about fathers who don't live with their sons, or who have limited custody, or who work long hours? Can they still build this foundation? That's a crucial question, and the research actually offers some hope here. The quality of father involvement matters much more than the quantity. There's a body of work on non-resident fathers that shows that when fathers are consistent, emotionally available, and engaged during the time they do have, even if it's limited, their children can still form secure attachments. The key is predictability. The child needs to know when dad will be there and that dad will be fully present when he is.
It's not about hours logged. It's about reliability of presence.
And for fathers in that situation, I'd say the owning a beat advice is even more important. Find something that is consistently yours. A weekly video call, a particular activity when you're together, a bedtime story you always do, and protect it fiercely. That consistency is what the child's brain latches onto.
That's reassuring. The foundation can be built even if the circumstances aren't ideal.
And I'd add one more thing. For non-resident fathers, the relationship with the mother is especially critical. High-conflict co-parenting relationships make it much harder for the father to maintain consistent, positive engagement with the child. Whatever you can do to keep the co-parenting relationship functional, that's an investment in your relationship with your son.
We're back to the ecosystem thing. The father-son relationship doesn't exist in a vacuum.
It never does. And that's maybe the most important thing to understand about the first 2 years. You're not just building a relationship with your son, you're building a family system. Every part of it affects every other part. The more you can tend to the whole system, your relationship with your partner, your own mental health, the rhythms and routines of the household, the more solid the foundation will be for you and your son.
That's a good place to land. Attention, consistency, acceptance, and tending the whole system.
That's the summary, yeah.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, records from a Mongolian monastery described monks observing strange behavior in the local permafrost, bubbles of what they called earth breath, escaping from frozen ground during spring thaw, which they believed were the sighs of ancestors trapped beneath the ice. When ignited with a torch, the bubbles produced a pale blue flame that the monks interpreted as a spiritual omen rather than the methane release it actually was.
To wrap this up, the prompt asked how fathers can lay solid foundations for a lifelong relationship with their sons in those first 2 years. I think what we've landed on is that the foundation isn't one big thing. It's thousands of small moments of genuine attention, stacked up over time, in a system that supports rather than undermines them. The question for fathers isn't, am I doing enough, but am I paying attention to the actual child in front of me?
If you're asking the question at all, if you're wondering how to build that foundation, you're probably already doing better than you think. The fathers who worry about being good fathers are rarely the ones who need to worry.
That's a good note. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.